good to have you here tonight. And as you know, on Thursday night, basically any question you want to ask about the Bible, we're here for you to get whatever you want to get out of it. And we try to encourage you all week long to study the Bible and get into it. And then we come together on Thursday night to have a good time with any question you want to ask about the Word of God. So having said all that, who wants to kick us off tonight and get us going? Yes, sir. Alex. I'm sorry? Judges chapter 1.
Can you explain the importance of cutting off the great toes and thumbs?
The verse what now?
Verse 7? Yes, sir. And is there an importance of the 70 kings being killed? Or do they represent anything?
Oh, okay. And Adonabezek said, 70 kings, having their thumbs and their great toes cut off, gathered their meat under my table, as I have done, so God hath requited me. And they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. What's your question?
What's the importance of getting their thumbs and their big toes cut off?
Okay. You're going to find there's different places in the Bible where they do this to somebody. And fundamentally, it's an act of humiliation. Only people who have great toes and thumbs are human beings. Animals don't have them. And so it relegates a person to an animal status. Not only that, but it will keep a person, and I know you don't think about this because we all have them, but if you lose your big toe, both big toes, and your thumb, it really affects the balance of your walk and everything that you do. The big toe may not look like much, but till you miss it, but it keeps a person off balance, and it would be an act of humiliation, first off, that it would keep somebody, everybody would know that, you know, that what happened to them. But then at the aspect of it, he would never, if he was a warrior or a great king or somebody that was really good in combat, he would never be that again, simply because of the fact that of losing his big toe and his thumb. So that's the reason why they did that. That's a great question. I don't think anybody's ever asked that in my whole life before. Except myself, when I asked myself that years ago. Huh? You asked me?
No, I didn't.
Oh, somebody did? Okay. Yes, sir.
Could you reminisce a little bit about...
Reminisce?
Yeah, about your relationships with God and since he died today.
Oh, yeah. I was going to tell everybody at the end, if you don't know, that Dr. Ruckman passed away today and went home to be with the Lord about 11. I must have been around 11 o'clock. I got a call about 11:20. He went home to be with the Lord. His question is, could I just talk a little bit about reminisce? Anything in particular? You want me to?
Your history with
him. Yeah. I told you a while back, when it first looked like that he wasn't going to make it, and he almost died a couple of times. I got a couple of phone calls saying that he probably wasn't going to make it through the weekend, but then he did. But I had told you a while back that I was going to preach you a message that was, but I had to wait till one other event took place, and it was probably going to be the most significant from a historical standpoint for you as a Christian that you probably would ever get. Not because I'm preaching it, but because of the facts involved. But I told you I had to wait for one thing to happen, and that was his death. I couldn't ever preach it before he died, but now that he is, in the next month or so, I'll give you plenty of notice. It's probably going to take me a little longer than a normal Sunday morning, so We'll probably streamline the service that morning and give me as much time as I can. I want to, you know, I want to do it justice. But I think it will be, now that he's gone, and I know many people don't grasp this or understand this, but it truly, today, whether you know it or not, or you're aware of it or not, today ended an era. And I thought it was, I always watch for these things. I thought that Ruckman died today and then Prince died today too. And all day long over everything, I was so sick of seeing it, you know, all day long. You know, here's a guy that it died when he was 56 or 57, you know, who never did one thing for the Lord. And the tweets of all of the other musicians, you know, one of them said, "Heaven's band just got a little louder today." I doubt that. But here's a guy that lived for 94 years. And after he got saved as a young man, dedicated his life to the Lord and to the things of the Lord. And, you know, it's something that I want to take the time, and I want you to understand. I don't care about anybody else on this planet, whether they get it or they don't get it. I want you to get it. I think it's probably the single most historical event. And when I lay it out, you'll understand why. That you could ever get. You know, when I got right with the Lord back in 1972, I really didn't know what to do. I had my background in astronomy. I went to camp. I told Mel Sabaka, my father in the Lord, I said, "Look, I really want to help." And I remember the time. I look back on it. It was funny, you know. They wanted me so long to get right with the Lord, and I did. Now they didn't know what to do with me, but here I was. And so I said to my, I have a telescope, and I know about things. Maybe we could just show the kids I'll come out and show the kids some stuff. And immediately they thought that was a great idea. So they put me with a guy by the name of Chuck Schuster. And Chuck Schuster became my mentor, along with a lot of other guys. And we gave birth from that together, the Gospel of the Star program, which we did for years and years and years, traveling all around everywhere, did it. And but it was going out to camp is where I first met Dr. Ruckman. Back then, and this was in the early 70s, he was an evangelist. And he was traveling around to a number of churches, preaching all the time. And he came to Canton Baptist Temple two times a year. Once for camp, and he always preached senior high camp. And then he came back at another time of the year for a week of revival. And those were the first times that I ever was introduced to him. Once I got introduced to him, I remembered years and years even before that, when I was just a little kid. This would have been back in the 50s. I remember him coming to the old Canton Baptist Temple, which was right across from where I lived, and remember him preaching. I remember him, not that he preached, but he drew when he preached. And So things were starting to come back, that even all the way back to then, he'd been in evangelism for years and years and years. And he was one of the most unique preachers that you ever heard, simply because he had the unique ability to draw while he was preaching and illustrate. He called them chalk talks. But they were just, you know, he had a real unique ability to do that. And so it was going out to camp that that I got introduced to him. And him and Mel were probably the two of the closest people that you could ever want. They were just two peas in a pod. And we kind of, in our little inner group there, we just kind of always had fun with Brother Pete and a lot of things. You know, his last name is Ruckman. He's German. He was very proud of his German heritage. In fact, when he was in his 70s, he traveled to Germany once a year for two or three weeks at a time, and just did nothing but pass out tracts to the German people and witness to them. He had a real burden for the German people. And he was a character, of course. And I remember one time he was coming into camp, and he flew into Cleveland Airport, and we all went up, you know, all the gang, the guys, you know, went up to pick him up. And we always liked to try to embarrass him. Of course, you couldn't embarrass him. So it was not like 9 or 10 of us, and Sabaka too. And we all got German helmets and went into the Cleveland Airport. And when he come off the plane, we all put the German helmets on and lined up and Sieg Heiled. Like he was the Fuhrer. Try it today and you'd be in jail for sure. This was back in the 70s. You could do things like that. And he thought it was the greatest thing in the world. He never forgot it. He always made a reference to that. And, you know, that's where I first got my introduction to how great the Bible was. I remember him preaching one night in a revival. He preached on the gospel according to Exodus. I still have the cassette tape. It was in 1973. I still have the cassette tape. I wouldn't try to play it today, but I have the tape. I never in my life ever heard anybody lay out the scriptures like he laid out Exodus chapter 12. It was one of the. I sat there and I remember going home that night and I thought to myself, I will never know the Bible like that. And yet I wanted to so desperately. It was one of the things that was just absolutely captivated me. How he got out of that passage, what he got out of it. And it was absolutely phenomenal. And, you know, from camp, when he came to camp, it was a thing where I just wanted the Bible. I would listen to him. I was young at the time. I don't know what I know now about him and as the process. But it was a thing that I just was overwhelmed. It was something that it motivated me more to ever want to learn the Bible. I remember the first book that I ever studied that he wrote was Genesis. And I couldn't believe it. And I was single at the time, and my mom and my dad had died, and my mom had moved out. She had gotten remarried. So I was living by myself. And I just dedicated those early years. I'd go to work. I worked at the Hoover Company at that point in time. I'd come home, get home about 4 o'clock, and immediately I'd jump in the book for two and a half hours, before I had to go to church or do whatever I had to do. And then I'd come back, and I would stay up till 10, 11 o'clock, 11:30, hitting it again. And I'd do that every day. On Saturdays, when I could get 3 or 4 or 5 hours in it, I just devoured the books. And I would go through them, and I would glean everything out and then write it in my Bible and just break it down. Much like the outlines that I've given you, I learned from going through that. And back then, he didn't have all of the books that he had as he's got now. As I got a little farther in it, I found out that there was a guy by the name of Greg Estep who was down in Exenia, Ohio. He had a bookstore. And I found that he had all of Ruckman's tapes that Ruckman had done in his Bible classes. Now, these are tapes that are done back in the 60s. And as far as I am concerned, he was at his peak in the 60s and the 70s, maybe the 80s too. Not that he wasn't good all through it, but I mean, everybody hits his peak. I hit mine when I was 14, so you got what's left over. I found out that he had almost every book of the Bible, verse by verse, on cassette tape, and I couldn't believe it. And I put a second mortgage on our house to go down to Exenia and buy every one of those tapes, and I still have those tapes today. They're all on cassette. The book of Isaiah was 90-minute tapes. Ezekiel was 32 90-minute tapes. And these are books of the Bible that never have been in print, a lot of the tapes. He's got a lot of books out now over the years, but there's still a lot of stuff on tape that he never did, that was classroom stuff. And I just, this is where I learned my Bible. I went to work. It took me 10 years. But I went to work going through every one of those and putting them in my Bible. I still have those tapes today. I wasn't going to say this just yet, but since you asked the question, I'll go ahead and step into this thing. I don't use them anymore. I haven't used them for years. I pretty much got everything in here, and they're just collecting dust. And I got 15 shelves of them. I counted them last week. 15 shelves of cassette, every book of the Bible, just about, and as in depth as you could ever want it. And I was going to ask five guys to come over and help me clean it out. Was going to give them to you, and you could just divide them up among yourselves. But I got told by several different people that wouldn't work. So I think what we're going to do with those is, if I can get some people that will help do it, is give all of those and develop a library here where you can check them out. But I need somebody that will be willing to head up the library. One of the things we got to do, this is on cassette tapes that were made in the 1970s. So there's going to be a problem of the tapes breaking if we're not careful with them. And on the other hand, that, not too many of you folks have a cassette player. I do. I have 8 tracks. I think they're coming back someday. But
can you just
convert
them onto
CD?
I'm sorry?
Burn them to a CD.
That's exactly what Aaron and some of the guys want to do. But here's the problem. We're talking about probably 5,000 or 6,000, 7,000 tapes. So it's going to take people that are willing to get involved to help do that. And I hadn't really made a mention of it yet because I just, you know, but since we're talking about it tonight, I would like that for you guys to have them, what I learned out of it. And it would be something that you would sign out and somebody would be responsible to make sure that you didn't leave town with them or whatever, you know. But, you know, when I, that's where I really learned my Bible. And then in 1976, I came out to Kansas City, and I took over being the youth pastor at the Kansas City Baptist Temple and with Truman Dollar. And Mel had went to New York, and before Mel had went, I had made good friends with a guy up in Rochester, New York, by the name of George Grace. He had become the pastor of the First Bible Baptist Church of Rochester, New York. And they had Dr. Ruckman on a regular basis. They are the ones, now I know that you guys, some of the guys go down to the Ruckman's Bad Attitude Baptist Blowout. Most people do not know that Ruckman did not start the Bad Attitude Baptist Blowout. The Bad Attitude Baptist Blowout started in Rochester, New York in about 1980. And for 20 years, you know, I preached at those with Dr. Ruckman. And they were some great times. I mean, there'd be every night for 5 nights, there'd be 3,000 people. I mean, it was just a packed out, and it was crazy, man. It was crazy. And so I went from getting to know him basically at camp, him obviously motivating me in the Bible to the point where like nobody else ever did, where God opened a door then for me to preach with him, and for probably 10 or 15 years, we did that. George, at one point, dropped the Bad Attitude Baptist Blowout slogan, and then Ruckman picked it up, and that's when it started down in his place. And he kind of broke fellowship with George over the thing. George stopped it simply because of the fact that one of the ladies in the church had come up to him and said, "What are we teaching our kids about always having good attitudes if we have a bad attitude, Baptist blowout? You know, we're teaching our kids not to have a bad attitude." Well, the answer to that is, as a Christian, there are some things you should have a bad attitude about. And the Word of God being perverted is one of them. But be that to say, you know, to keep peace in the family, so to speak, they dropped the bad attitude, and then it kind of degenerated from there. But 15, 16, I don't know, maybe 17 years, it was great preaching. Some great preachers up there. And I preached at it every year, I got to go pick Ruckman up at the hotel and bring him over, you know, and we got to talk and things like that. But it was a thing where he probably more than any other man motivated me and gave me a vision of what was really in the Bible. I think I know what I'm talking about based on my own experience in the Bible and people that I've read and the people that I've worked with, talked to, fellowshiped with in 40 some years of ministry. I would say that, and there's a reason for this, and we'll get into this when we get into our sermon that Sunday morning. There is no doubt in my mind that he was the greatest mind on the English Bible in the 20th century. No doubt in my mind about it. Was he weird? No question about it. Did he have some goofy things? Like you don't. But when it came to the point where he opened that Bible, it was incredible. I tell people, I think I told you last Thursday night, that I've studied a lot of guys. I never wanted to just focus on one thing. I felt like that I wanted to be well-rounded. I didn't want just one person. I knew there would be one main person that I would really haul into, but I wanted to shave off the edges and keep myself balanced out with it. So I studied a lot of guys. I studied, as I told you the other time, I studied Larkin. Larkin, at the turn of the century, Larkin was the man. There's no question about it. Every fundamentalist today that claimed himself to be a fundamentalist learned his fundamentals from Clarence Larkin, who wrote his stuff around 1900. No question about it. A.W. Pink, Arthur Pink. I learned a great thing from Pink. Pink was a Calvinist. And he didn't start out to be a Calvinist, but he got to be a Calvinist someplace in his journeys through life. And I learned something, a great truth from that. Now, Arthur W. Pink, his gleaning in Genesis, his gleaning in Exodus, his gleaning in Joshua, I don't even know what to tell you. There isn't any better practical material anywhere on the planet. I still have messages that I preach that I put together 40-some years ago out of gleanings in Genesis. Absolutely phenomenal stuff. But when you got to be careful with him, because when he got a little bit farther on, he wrote a Gospel of John and he wrote an commentary on Hebrews. And they became pretty worthless because his Calvinism got too much into that. And so they weren't worth really dealing with. But I learned a great thing. I learned from studying everybody I studied and then looking at Pink. I learned that a guy who is a Calvinist, the reason why he is a Calvinist fundamentally is because he really doesn't know anything about the Bible. Pink has some of the greatest devotional stuff you'll ever get in your life. But you know what? He couldn't explain the millennium or the tribulation period if his life depended on it. Every book that he wrote was a practical book, as good as it was. It was a practical book that was great on the practical side of inspirational side, but there was no doctrine to it. He wouldn't understand the 18 types of the Antichrist if they fell out of a tree and hit him on the head. He couldn't identify the 21 types of Christ. He knew nothing about the millennium. He couldn't lay Ezekiel chapter 40 through chapter 48 out if you put a gun to his head. And I learned a great truth, that it isn't just about the practical side. The truth that I learned is that everything in the Bible, practical, historical, has to come back down to a doctrinal foundation. And I learned that by watching the guys who had the doctrinal, but also had the practical, and then watching a guy who had no doctrine, who had the practical, but wound up being a heretic. And I learned a lesson that the thing that keeps us from falling into heresy is doctrine. And doctrine is the key. And so, I studied all those guys. I like Larkin. But I'll be honest with you, if you get Larkin's Dispensational Truth, that big book that we sell in a bookstore, when he comes to the creation there in the beginning, you might as well take an X-Acto cutter and cut those pages out. And, you know, put little red stickies on them and use them as a target for about 50 feet. I mean, they're worthless. His concept of Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 and verse 2 is completely bogus. But I understand why. He was writing during a time period of 1900 where the evangelicals and the neo-orthodox were coming into their own, and everybody wanted to be a scholar. And during that time period, the great argument was what was taking place in the Bible between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. And the scholarly world was not recognizing anybody as a scholar that believed that a fist fight broke out between God and the devil between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2 and threw the universe into chaos. That was not scholarly. So all these guys that were so good on everything else fudged on Genesis chapter 1. So he comes up with some kind of cloud canopy theory, just total ridiculous stuff. But I understand why he did it. I went through him. I went through Pink, Calvinist. I went through Darby. I went through Evans. I went through all of them. And every one of them was good to some point, but they all fell apart at some point. And I said this the other Thursday night when it came to Dr. Ruckman and his teaching. I found that I could trust it without question. And that doesn't mean I didn't question it. I'm just saying, I'm giving you my analysis after 40 plus years of sifting through everybody's material. So I know what I'm talking about here. I mean, I know how to fix my car, but I know how I'm talking about here. And I saw that about 95% of the time he was right on the money. Now, I say 95 with 5% error, but I also tell you this, and I told you the other night, I never found 5%, but I'm just giving that in there so I don't say 100%. I've never found him wrong on anything. Now, he's messed up on some things with practical things. He lives down south. That's another whole culture down there. I get it. Many people accuse him of being a racist. You know what? I've known the man. He's not a racist. But he lives in the south. South people back then look at things differently. Let me tell you something. A lot of the books that people read and said, well, he's a racist, was written during the 60s when everybody talked that way. But you people forget the time element of the thing. I don't agree with everything that he did. I don't agree with everything that he said. But when it came down to the Bible and the doctrine aspect of the Bible, you couldn't touch him. Couldn't touch him. And so I began to invest my whole life in trying to get the Bible down to the point where I could understand it. He's the one that taught me about every book of the Bible has a context. He's the one that taught me about the types in the Bible. He's the one that showed me and laid out for me how that the doctrinal application, how you can get the three applications out. Most people never learn the Bible simply because they don't have a structure in learning the Bible. He taught me structure. Where the military taught me structure in my personal life, Ruckman taught me structure in my biblical life. And but you don't know that at the end of World War II, he was a second lieutenant in the Army. He was part of the occupation of Japan. He had a very military mindset in everything that he did. His father was a general in the Army. He come from a military background. One of his ancestors fought in the Civil War. He's a military mind backset all the way back. And I gravitated to that. And where the military taught me structure in my own personal life, he taught me that it takes a structure to learn the Bible. And I see so many people today wasting their time with the Bible, just stabbing in the dark. Nick and I were talking about this before. Where's Nick at? Nick and I were talking... Nick and I were talking about this when he came in to ask questions about the Bible before. That you got to have a structure when it comes to the Bible. He taught me that. He taught me that a text without a context is a pretext. And he showed me that whatever I want to know in the Bible, I have to go back and establish a context. He showed me where every book in the Bible has a context. And when I want to get a verse understood in the Bible, I've got to first back up and understand the context of the book and then work my way back. He gave me a structure. Most people just read the Bible. They remind me of the Christian, you know, that needed a verse. And they close their eyes, flip their Bible, and pull it down. And that's how they get the verse that they need. You know, and they wind up getting one about the Omer's a tenth of an ephah or something like that, you know. He taught me structure. He showed me how that everything I do in that Bible has to have within a structure. And those structures are made up of the books of the Bible. The books of the Bible are made up of another inner structure, the chapters of the Bible. And the chapters of the Bible are made up of even a finer inner structure, the verses of the Bible. And the verses in the Bible are made up of even a finer structure, the words in the Bible. And every one of those structures, from the Bible to the chapters to the verses to the words, or the keys to unlock it when you put it in the right structure. I wrote my book on how to study the Bible 40-some years ago in one of the chapters, and there are key words in the Bible. I've given them to you many, many, many times. They unlock it, and they unlock it because they set a context. So, coming through everything that I did in my life, the time that, you know, from way back at camp when I first heard him preach, to the times when I, you know, came and preached with him, to the times that I got into it and just went through every book of that Bible that he had. I gleaned everything I could. I talk about Mel Sabaka being my father in the Lord, and that's a give me. He's the one that invested the time in my life. But he's not the one who taught me the Bible. He taught me a lot about the Bible. But the one who really taught me my Bible was Dr. Ruckman. And the two of them were like, as I said, were like two peas in a pod. They were inseparable. They may not see each other for 3 or 4 years. And when they met, it was like they just had seen each other an hour ago. It was an incredible relationship. And they both had the same mindset. In fact, it was Dr. Ruckman who got Mel Sabaka straightened out on the King James Bible. Mel Sabaka told the testimony many, many times that he was working at a juvenile detention center as a superintendent, and he was going to Kent State University, which was there in Canton, and his whole life was going to be working with penal system with incorrigible young people, and that's how he started out, and he was going to the Baptist temple, and he got saved under Harold Henniger. This had to be in the early 50s. And so it was a thing where at that point, he really started to question what he was learning at Kent State University. He was hearing one thing here, and yet the professors were telling him something else here. And he was being told at Kent State University that you couldn't know anything for sure, that there was no absolute. And he would hear Ruckman come and preach and some of the guys, and they would talk about that the Word of God being an absolute. And that just drove him off the wall. And one night he got a hold of Ruckman, and this was the cementing of their friendship. One night I've heard him tell the story many, many times. One night he got a hold of Ruckman after a service, and he sat down with him, and he said, "Okay, I want to know. Is there an absolute?" I don't know what went on in the meeting. That meeting went on for several hours. But I know this. When Mel Sabaka come out of that meeting, he had an absolute. And that's the effect that he had on men back then. And that's the effect that, in a different way, that he had on me. When I got saved, you talk about God following in somebody's footsteps. When I got right with God and I began to want to serve the ministry, you know the first place God put me in? He put me in the same Stark County Detention Center as the chaplain. And I followed in his footsteps. Where he was the superintendent, I was the chaplain. But I pretty much had the run of the place to go in and do Sunday services all the time, work with the kids. In fact, we kind of adopted a little guy out of there. His mom was a hooker and a drug addict, and his dad had left him, and there was a little guy by the name of Shane Crawford, and he was 14 years old when he was arrested for stealing a car. And that was his third account, and they went to the I won him to Christ at the juvenile detention center. He was coming up for trial, and I went to the judge with the trial with him, and I told the judge that if he would release him into my custody, that I would guarantee that we would do everything to do to try to help him. I tried to ask him not to send him away, put him in a detention home, which is nothing but a gladiator school, and it made him worse. The judge released him on my cognizance that if I would work with him, that boy is today in the ministry. And it was a process that, you know, that's the things that God did. And I never really told anybody that story, but it's a true story. And so, you know, I followed in a lot of these guys' same footsteps. These were the last of the last of the last of the Philadelphian guys. I would say that in the 1900s, in the 20s, and the 30s, you had the last of the Philadelphians. And then by the time you got to the 40s and the 50s, you had the last of the last. And by the time you got to the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, you had the last of the last of the last. And today, they're all gone. They're all gone. If they're not dead, they're in a coma someplace or a vegetable in an old folks home. But they're gone. They're gone. They're gone. And, you know, it's something that it's hard to put into one sentence of my life, you know, what these guys did for me. But I can tell you this. Everything I try to do for you is simply based on what they did for me. May I say something now? The difference is that I appreciated it more than anything on this planet, and some of you don't. But it's nevertheless, that's what it is. It's a thing where they changed my life. He gave me my absolute. God put two men in my life, really three men in my life, but a third one a little bit later on. But God put two main men in my life. And for those two guys, it really formed up and gave me not only the foundation that I needed, that Mel gave me, and the opportunities of ministry that Mel gave me, but then the Bible that Ruckman gave me. He gave me structure to it. I don't know where I would be today if God wouldn't have put him in my life and allowed me to have the access to what I had to learn the structure of the Bible. But I can take that one step further. I don't know where you'd be today.
Amen.
Because it's an ongoing process. And there takes structure for you to get down what God wants you to have. Everything in life has to work through a system. And most cases, the system is corrupt or it's no good. But when it comes to the Bible, God has an absolute system by which He imparts truth. And I learned that system. I can only tell you that it worked for me. I don't claim to be anybody who knows a lot about the Bible. I told you a couple of weeks ago, the more I learn the Bible, the more I know how much I don't know the Bible. I have no pride when it comes to what I think I know about the Bible. I have no attitude about it. I know how dumb I really am, and I know how wicked I really am, and I know that, you know, I don't deserve one thing out of this book.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're ever going to get it by the grace of God, it's going to come through a structure, and it's going to have to be God's structure. And what I have here in this church is nothing more than the structure that God taught me. I'm only doing for you what somebody did for me. I've never really told you that. I don't really harp on that. I don't try to play that up. But I was somebody who was lost in the world, and I didn't know where I was going, and somebody put my feet on the ground and gave me an absolute and gave me a structure. And it changed everything about my life. And all I know how to do is to do for you what somebody did for me. And if it, believe me, if it worked for this idiot, it'll work for you. So that's my rendition of it, you know, in a way that there'll never be another one like him. And I will tell you right now, no man who walks this earth will ever fill his shoes or take his place. And there's a reason for that. And when I lay out, coming up in a couple of weeks, and I'll give you plenty of notice, and we'll have to streamline the service, but I want everybody in this church, and we're going to bring the kids in because I want your kids to hear it. It is probably the single most historical application to who we are that you will ever get in your life. And you need to know it. You need to know it. Yeah.
I was going to say, I've got Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John done.
Okay. What are they again?
Ecclesiastes,
Song of Solomon,
1st, 2nd,
and 3rd John. The outlines are ready to go. They're done in there.
Your tapes put on CD.
My tapes?
Yeah. That Ruckman did.
Oh, the Ruckman tapes, not my tapes.
Well, yeah.
How'd you get them?
I borrowed them from you.
Oh, you had them for me?
Yeah.
No wonder I couldn't find those. Wasn't there a rental fee on those? And I know there's a late fee now. But, okay, well, we're well on our way to getting that done. And if you would like to help with that, she Aaron and she John, and I'm more than willing to just give them to you guys and let you guys go to work with them and do whatever you need to be done. Does that help you? And if somebody else may have a question about that, or so you have another question, but yes, sir. Yeah.
Okay. A while back, you said J. Frank Norris and Ruckman were very useful for the KJV.
Yeah, just hang on to that one. You just don't worry about that one. We'll get to that here in a couple of weeks. But you're right. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, sir.
What was the funniest thing you can remember that Mr. Ruckman ever did?
The funniest thing that Ruckman ever did.
The two-foot camp.
What?
The two-foot camp.
Oh, yeah. The funniest thing that Ruckman ever did is we used to have, when at camp, we'd always, I don't know if anybody ever, he loved German stuff. And there was a record out, it was done by, they were great musicians. But it was a funny record because they played all the songs out of tune. And it was something like Glockenspiel's Sauerkraut Band. I still got it someplace. I mean, it was hilarious. They'd play some of the great classics and they would just be out of tune, hit the wrong notes. But just enough that kept it okay, but you'd laugh yourself sick listening to it. And Ruckman would fall on the floor listening to that. I took it out to him one time and I said, Brother Peter, you got to hear that. We were sitting in a cabin and we put it on. I thought he was going to have a stroke. He was laughing. He got on the floor. He could not handle it. So we got a bunch of guys together, and the last night at camp, we all played instruments. They were part of my brass ensemble that played on Sunday night. Ruckman played the tuba. And so we all put, again, German helmets on, and the last night at camp, we all did our rendition of I forget what song it was, but in the form of Glockenberg's Sauerkraut Band. And it was the funniest. And Ruckman would play the tuba, but he couldn't get one note out. Because the whole tuba would be shaking up and down with the fact that he just enjoyed and laughed at that so much. And it was the stupidest thing on the planet, but it was the funniest thing you ever heard. And that was the funniest thing I remember with him. Now, it was the funniest thing I remember with Sabaka. And we laughed about this for 30 years. We were working out the camp. And we were building an observatory out there because the Gospel and the Stars had really grown. And we were actually putting in an observatory to bring groups out. And we were working there, and we had to go down to the hardware store to get some stuff. And so, you know, wherever one went, everybody went. I mean, that's just the way it was. So I had my little list, and I'm going around, and I could not figure out, but this guy who ran the place was right there with me everywhere I was going. And I'd pick something out, and he'd take it out of my hand and carry it. And I'm thinking, man, this is great service. Well, this went on for about 15 minutes, and so we start to come back up, and I got a whole basket of stuff, but the guy's carrying it, and he's just staying right with me. And I see Sabaka and a bunch of them over here just laying on the floor, laughing. And so I don't know what's going on. I get the stuff, pay for it, we got it, and they're going crazy. And he told me, he said, when they went in there, when I was going to get my stuff, he called the guy over and he says, I'm Reverend Sabaka. I'm down here from the camp. We have a work release program, and this young man here has just gotten out of jail, and he is a kleptomaniac. And I'm just telling you, we will not be responsible for anything that he picks up and puts in his pocket. And the guy believed me, man. So he's walking around with me, and everything I'm doing, he's taking it out of my hand and putting it into the deal. We laughed about that for the next 30 years. So anyway, next question, or another question, or whatever. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I'm working on word context and all that stuff.
I'm sorry?
I said I'm working on the word context and all that stuff in the Bible, and I was wondering, I know brass is supposed to be related to judgment, and iron is usually related to the Antichrist and stuff, so why was there iron and brass on the temple? In the Old Testament.
Well, not here again. Her question is that iron in the Bible will many times be associated with the sons of God, Genesis 6. Brass in the Bible represents judgment many times. Her question is, if that's true, why do you find that within the building of the temple? And, of course, the answer to things like that is it's not 100% every time you find it. Here again, you got to look at the context. It's like, you know, I'll say that, you know, and you'll hear me say, I'll say, you know, 95% of the time when you find this word, it'll mean this. That means that 5% or so you won't. So you got to look at the rest of the context to see and understand, because it obviously brass and iron are brass and iron in its own right. And it may not represent something here that it intended to represent something here. In Daniel 2, when you get over there, and it talks about the iron mingled with clay down around Daniel chapter 2. We know that from the context there, the iron mingled with clay is dealing with the Antichrist and the 10 toes of Daniel's image, which is the 10 confederated nations found in the book of Revelation. So the Bible says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall be in the coming of the Son of Man. So we see the clay represents human bodies, and the iron represents the sons of God. So we know there that it's just like it was in Noah's time, at the second coming time, the sons of God are going to come back down again. But the reason you know that is the extended context of what you're reading, not just the word. But you got to look at the context of everything. In other words, every word will have a context within the sentence that is in that you got to look at.
Well, yeah.
There you go, a rod of iron, because rod of iron can also mean a hard line judgment. So you got to look at the context. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you've covered this before, but there's a definitive passage about church history and Revelation. Is there like a parallel passage in the Old Testament about church history being prophetic? I mean, I don't know if there is one, or maybe you already covered it.
All right, say what now?
You know, like the church age, you know, like the history in Revelation, that, you know, like the seven churches represent the church age. Is there anything like that in the Old Testament prophetically for the church? I mean, as far as it references back? Yeah.
You mean anything in the Old Testament that references the church age?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the church?
No, there's not.
Okay.
This is a great question. You will find that there are no direct references in the Old Testament to the church. Now, I'll show you why that is. Come over to Romans chapter 16. Now, Paul, we know, is the apostle to the church. And it's revealed to him. We want to remember that. And when he writes the book of Romans, he writes the book of Romans as the handbook of doctrine to the church, for the church. So when he's done with this book, he sums up Romans in Romans chapter 16 by saying this, verse 25. Now to him that is of power to establish you according to my gospel and the preaching. Now notice Paul called it his gospel. The gospel he's talking about is the gospel of the grace of God. It wasn't his gospel. It was the gospel of Jesus Christ. But notice how he claims ownership of it, and he calls it my gospel because it was given first to him. That's very, very important that you see that. Nobody else could make that claim that the gospel of Jesus Christ was his gospel in that sense. Now to him that is of power to establish you according to my gospel and the preaching of Jesus Christ according to the revelation of the mystery, now here it comes, which was kept secret since the world began. Now that mystery that he's talking about there is the church. That Bible says that the church, the concept of the church, was not revealed in any way, shape, or form directly in the Old Testament. That it was kept a mystery, a secret, until since the world began. Now look at verse 26. But now, Paul, is made manifest, and by the scriptures of the prophets, according to the commandment of the everlasting God, made known to all nations for the obedience of faith. Now, when I say that there's no direct revelation of the church in the Old Testament, you will find places in the Old Testament. I'll show you. Come over to Daniel. And this happens all the time. I'll come over to Daniel. Daniel chapter 9. Now, this is a prophecy on the 70 weeks of Daniel, and I'm not going to get into it. I'm going to tell you what it is, and I'm going to show you what I want to show you. This is showing you, basically, that there's going to be, from the time that they rebuild Jerusalem, there's going to be 490 years till the coming of Christ. And it's commonly called Daniel's 70th week. And the formula is here, 1 week of this 70 weeks equals 7 years, equals 490 years total. Now watch this. Verse 24, 70 weeks are determined upon my people and upon the holy city to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring an everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore that understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem, that'll be in Nehemiah, Esther, and Ezra. That's where it happens. To build Jerusalem until the Messiah, the Prince, shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks, and the street shall be built again and the wall even in troublous times. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, that's the crucifixion of Christ, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come and shall destroy the city and the sanctuary of the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war of desolations are determined. You see what it did? It brought you right up to the crucifixion of Christ, and then it jumped right over the church age and went right into the tribulation period. That happens over and over and over and over again in the Old Testament. And the reason why that is because that church age was a mystery that was kept secret from the foundation of the world, or from the beginning, and is not revealed until Paul shows up. So you will find no, and I use the word again, I'm going to explain myself here in a minute. You'll find no direct revelations in the Old Testament about the church. Now, I say that, you will find all kinds of types of the church in the Old Testament. You will find passages in there that will clearly show you the church in type. Here's the difference. You would not know under any circumstances that that church, that type in the Old Testament, was a picture of the church until you have the New Testament revealed and the church comes into effect. See what I'm saying? In other words, the fact that you got the church age now illuminates the type in the Old Testament. If you didn't have the New Testament, you would never see it. The standard teaching is that everybody in the Old Testament looked forward to the cross, and that everybody in the New Testament looks back to the cross. That's the standard heresy that's put out with 98% of the stupid people out there who stupidly try to teach the Bible. Now, I agree that we in the church age look back toward the cross. No question about that. Nobody in the Old Testament looked forward to the cross. The biggest way I know that is because if the nation of Israel was looking forward to the cross, then why did they crucify him? Hello? But that's the stupidity that we deal with when you get a college education about the Bible. Nobody in the Old Testament is looking for the cross. The Bible tells you in the book of Hebrews chapter 11 that Abraham was looking for a city whose builder and maker was God. He's looking for the millennial reign of Christ, the Messiah coming as king. That is the predominant concept of the Old Testament. I get people all the time that will send me stuff that want me to look at, you know, and I really don't even mess with it. Most of it is so goofy, I don't even bother with it. But they're always showing me something that they found in the Old Testament that relates to the church directly. And I don't mess with it. I don't answer them back for the most part because I don't have time. And it's all email stuff. I ain't emailing somebody anything when a Bible question. You kidding me? You give me a question today about the Bible. My God, it'll take me 35 minutes to tell you about it. How long do you think it'll take me to type that out? It'll be the rest of my life. So I just don't mess with it. But there are no direct references in the Old Testament to the church. There's types. But you wouldn't know what they are unless you had a New Testament. And that's really, really the key. Yeah.
On the same topic, references to the Gentiles in the major prophets, specifically Isaiah 49:6, talking about I will give thee a light, for a light to the Gentiles, and give my salvation unto the end of the earth. I always thought that was an allusion to the salvation of the Gentile nations in the future.
It is, in the millennium.
Okay, but not the church specific.
No, not the church at all. There is no reference to the church. All that, but that's what happens, Craig. Guys will read that, and because they don't understand the context of Isaiah 49, and they don't understand the context of how the Bible lays out, they'll read that in there, and here is a place where the light is coming unto the Gentiles, so they got to make that the church. When, if you studied it out, you'll realize that there is a whole evangelistic crowd of 144,000 Jews, 12,000 from each tribe during the tribulation period, who go specifically bringing the light of the gospel of the everlasting kingdom to the Gentiles. But that's in the Bible pretty deep, you see. And it all goes back to that structure. So yeah, there is no direct references anywhere in the Old Testament to the church. You'll find, as I said, you'll find types, but the only reason you know that the types are that is because you have a New Testament. If you didn't have that, you wouldn't know about it. It's the New Testament, it opens it up. And that's why he says in Romans 16, and he closes out the book, where he says that it was kept as a secret from the beginning, and now it's revealed with Paul. And that's why he called it my gospel. Yeah.
So, my gospel, is that what he's talking about in Galatians 1:12?
Yes. He's talking that in Galatians, he's making a reference that the gospel, he didn't get it from any other man. Nobody taught him the gospel. He didn't read it in a book. Nobody gave it to him. He got the gospel directly from God. And in that sense, it's his gospel because he was the only one it was revealed to. And in the gospel of the church age, then he takes it and starts churches in Acts chapter 12, 13, and on through the three missionary journeys. And then it goes on from there.
Okay.
That's a good question. Yeah.
Like types of like the church, the characteristics of the churches, like Ephesus and Philadelphia and Laodicea. Are there types in the Old Testament that you found? Maybe that.
I've never found any types in the Old Testament of the seven churches in the New Testament. No, no. But there are types of the church in there. I mean, I could take you back to one of my favorite places back there is in 1 Samuel chapter. What is it? 22, where David. Goes down to the cave of Adullam down there. And he's down there in that cave. And the Bible says that all the distressed and all the people that are hurting and all the people that are broken and all the people that are busted, they come down there and they find, and Adullam means refuge is the word. And he says that they come down to a tune of about 400 people into that deal. To me, that's a picture of what a church should be. A church should be... No, probably more than about 400, maybe a little more. But you start to get to your mega church and then you lose the whole concept because what you can't minister to people. And then it becomes a thing. If you get a church hits 400, 500, the thing to do then is to split off, take a group of people and start another church. And but it's a thing where you have to get your church to the place where you're ready to do that. And... the thing I like about that is it clearly says that all these people were hurting and all these people were struggling with things. But if you look at David, David's running from Saul and he's got his own problems. And it just goes to show you that in any church, we're all in the same boat, folks. I got my problems, you got yours. Get in the cave. And they work through it together, you see. That's the key. It isn't some pastor sitting on a pinnacle someplace and he's got his all problem solved and you all down there little peons need my expertise and my revelations from God. It's that we're all in the same trench. We all eat the same mud. We all get the same blood splattered on us and we all fight the same war. We all got our issues. You help me, I'll help you. But we're all in the cave together. 400 in, 401, got to go someplace else. Now I will make room for you. Does that help you? Okay. Next question. Yes, sir.
Would the seven sisters of Pleiades represent...
The who now?
The seven sisters of Pleiades represent the church age?
Her question is about the Pleiades, which is a constellation, a winter constellation. And in our astronomical term, it's called the Seven Sisters. And the Seven Sisters, the Pleiades, were in mythological, were seven sisters who were kin to somebody who Perseus or Andromeda. I don't remember how it all goes. And his question is, in a biblical sense, do those seven sisters represent the church age? And I would say probably they do. But here again, you wouldn't know that till you have a New Testament that you have seven periods of church history. But yeah, I would say that they would. I teach that they do. Yeah. Yeah. And you can see it actually, it's really a part of a cluster, an open cluster, that has about 300 stars in it. But the naked eye can only see seven Some people can see only six, but it looks like a little kite. It'd be too low probably now for you to see. I don't know. But anyway, it's predominant in the wintertime overhead. And the eye can see seven, but if you put a telescope on it or a pair of binoculars, I took a picture of it and exposed it for like, two, 3 minutes, and I picked up like 200-300 stars, but you see the bright ones in it. I always thought that was kind of neat because I think personally that they represent the seven periods of church history at a glance, but when you look at church history and in depth inside, put a little magnification to it, church history, the seven churches are filled with people. So, my little analogy. Next question. Enough of my analogies. Yes, sir.
2 Corinthians 11:27.
Where is it?
2 Corinthians 11:27.
2 Corinthians 11:27. What do you say? Don't mess me up now. All right, 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 27. Is that your verse?
Yeah,
27. That says, in weariness, in painfulness, and thirst, in fastings.
What version do you have?
Didn't he say 2 Corinthians 11, verse 27?
Yeah.
Huh?
Just skip the line.
Try again.
I'm looking at 2 Corinthians chapter 11.
You're right.
You're right, Bob. You're right.
You're right.
You got it.
You skipped it.
Huh?
Read it again.
You just skipped a word.
Am I not reading the right verse?
No, you're right. Reset. Reset. Reset.
Just read it again.
In weariness and painfulness. In watchings often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness. That's your verse? What's your question?
Comparing that with 1 Corinthians 7, 4.
1 Corinthians 7, 4?
Right.
Oh, man. Keep switching these books on me here. 1 Corinthians 7, 4. Five four? Huh?
7-5.
All right, I'm going to read it if you'll shut up. Defraud ye not one another, except it be with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your inconsistency. Well, now in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, this is a husband and wife for a specific thing. This is not just everybody in the church. Well, if you notice here in verse 27 of chapter 11, and this is where I thought, I thought what you were going to ask. It says, in weariness and painfulness and watchings often, in hunger, thirst, and in fastings often, And notice that their hunger, thirst, and fasting are all three different things here. The average person thinks that fasting is just not eating. And that's not exactly true. I mean, it may be that, you know, it may be that when you fast that you don't eat. But he wants to make the point that fasting is not about not eating. In other words, most people think that if you, let me put it to you this way. Most people think that if you want to get a prayer answer, you just quit eating and God feels sorry for you in about a day and a half and then he answers you so you don't starve to death. If I was God, you'd all starve to death as far as I'm concerned. It's a thing where that's not what fasting, you know, fasting was never given. Fasting was never given for you to get your prayers answered. And this is the thing that you want to see here. So when he talks about in weariness and painfulness, in washings often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, hunger may go along with fasting, but fasting is not about hunger. Let's put it that way. Come on back to Psalms here, and I'll show you the two definitive passages on fasting in the Bible. See, we get the idea
Pharisees were asking, we fast, and John's disciples fast, and Jesus says, but the bridegroom's here, they don't need the fast, so if we got Jesus Christ inside of me, why do I need the fast?
Well, yeah, and you don't need the fast.
I know, but
you don't. But if you want to fast, that's okay too. But let me show you what fasting does for you, and this will maybe clear it up, because everybody gets screwed up on this. And I'm kidding you. Everybody I've ever met that ever did. Psalm 69 is where we're going, by the way. Everybody thinks that fasting is the way to get your prayer answered. And I've heard 1,000 times. And I never say anything to anybody because it's none of my business. I don't care. Let me tell you something. I got enough problems without dealing with yours. And I have people all the time, you know, well, I really had a thing with, I had a thing I was going through and I had a prayer that I was trying to get answered and I just fasted and prayed. And I get that because if you're just a surface person with the Bible and you've heard most preachers all your life teach, that's what they teach. And they teach that fasting is a way for you to get an answer to prayer. Or, in some cases, fasting is a way to get God to change his mind and do something different. Now, here's what I teach on prayer, just to give you a short rendition here. Bible teaches the greatest thing that you should know about your prayer life in Romans chapter 8 is you and I don't know how to pray. And a person who really understands prayer in the Bible realize that as a Christian, there's some things that we don't have a right to ask God to change. Well, that may be hard for some of God's people, but that's the bottom line. There are some things that you and I don't have a right to ask God to change. Because God may have brought that in your life for him to get the honor and glory out of it, and it may be uncomfortable for you and you don't want to go through it, so you pray to have him change it when it was by his design to have you go through it so he could get whatever honor and glory he wanted. Are you his or are you yours? See? Now look at Psalm 69. It says, when I wept and chastened my soul with fasting, that was to my reproach. Now that is the definitive verse on fasting in the Bible. One of them. There's two of them. The next one's in Psalms 35. So let's go over there here real quick. Somebody says, well, I've never heard this before. It's because we teach the Bible here. Psalms 35, verse 13. But as for me, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth. I humbled my soul with fasting, and my prayer returned into my own bosom. Now, here's what fasting does. Fasting doesn't get your prayer answered. Fasting doesn't necessarily change what God is in the process of doing. What fasting does, it chastens your soul. It humbles your soul. When you go for 2 or 3 or 4 days without eating anything, your flesh gives you fits. Fasting will remind you how despicable and how weak and how dependent you are on the flesh. Fasting will humble you. Fasting will chasten your spirit and your soul. And it will put you in a position not to change what God is doing, not to get an answer from what you want, but fasting will show you how wicked and weak and dependent we are on the flesh, and fasting will help you get into position to accept whatever God's doing the way He's doing it.
Amen.
That's what fasting is. And however you find it, and wherever you find it. But we get the idea, you know, that, well, I didn't get this, so I'm going to fast. I've actually had gals say, I want this guy, so I'm fasting for him.
No,
what's that song? How's that? Where's Maddie? How's that song go? Da 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 da. Oh, I don't know. Never mind. Yes. Listen up now. I can't hear.
Sorry.
Not you, them.
Jesus said that that this kind, this demon, only comes out by prayer and fasting. I was just wondering, how does that play into what you're talking about?
Well, because, and he's talking that, first of all, he's talking to his disciples when he's saying that. And they've come to the place where they've got their hearts hardened and they think they're really professionals and they're doing it with the wrong motive and around into the heart. So if anybody needed to have their souls and their spirits chastened and humbled, it was them. And that is the bottom line. You can't get this to happen. I'm not saying that God won't do some things through fasting. But it's not the primary reason you do it. Fasting puts you on the same level with God. Because the problem is, we don't know how to pray. And let's be honest, 99% of our prayer is selfish. Amen. It's about what we want over what God may want. And the only way you can get yourself on any kind of footing with God is to know how wicked we really are. And what's wicked about you and me is my flesh. So the only way I can get myself down on that level is to have my flesh just give me fits because I won't feed it. And boy, all as it takes. You think you're spiritual? You think you have control of your flesh? Just go eating, no eating for a day. Your flesh will control you. You will eat everything that doesn't eat you first. You will be in charge. You will not be in charge. And that shows us how wicked we really are. And so when you get down on that level, you can get a hold of God. And you can say, God, you know what? I haven't eaten for 2 or 3 days. I haven't eaten for a day. And boy, my flesh is just killing me. I am so wicked. Boy, you know what, Lord? It's all about me. It's all about this. And you know what? You're not giving me this or you're not answering this. And I think I want this. But Lord, I understand now how rottenly wicked I really am. And I'm just understand now that my flesh is in control of me. And I'm just coming to you. And I've been chastened in my spirit. I've been chastened in my soul. I know I'm afflicted. I know I don't know how to pray. So God, I understand how wicked I am. So God, I'm just going to rest that you do whatever you want to do because I don't know what I'm asking because I'm all screwed up. God says, now I can do something. Want some advice? Just come to that point in your life without fasting. Don't put yourself through the agony of not eating. What are you laughing at? Does anybody want to go through that? Just get to the place where you already say, God, there's some things I don't have a right to change. Just get to the point where Job was, that Job was going through everything he went and said, Job, what do you think about you praying and crying and doing all these things and you still get it? And your three buddies come over and they're giving you all kinds of problems and they're saying you're the problem when you lived your life. What do you think about this? God's not giving you any answers. He took your house, he took your cattle, he took your farm, he took your kids, should have took your wife. He took everything around you and then stuck three friends in your world who are giving you all kinds of fits. You're in sackcloth and ashes. You're in agony. What do you think why God's not answering you? And you know what he said? He says, I don't know, but I will tell you this. Yet though he slay me, will I trust him?
Amen.
Get there and then eat.
Amen.
Two double cheeseburgers. Get eat.